This is Robert Hood, award-winning author of spine-chillingly strange horror fiction and head zombie keeper at Undead Backbrain, which can be found at www.roberthood.net/blog. The guys at Broken Sea Audio Productions asked me to pop in today to promote their upcoming Halloween season release, Zombie Cheerleaders 2, The Pom-Poms of Death. And as something of an authority... Hey, what was that? Is someone there? This latest Broken Sea Living Dead effort is a great show, very realistic. Sexy cheerleaders, it's got it all. I think you should all download it as soon as it... Hey, wow. Great makeup, guys. Why do the zombies need makeup for an audio show? Holy crap, they're using real zombies!
Zombie Cheerleaders 2, Pom-Poms of Death. Coming Halloween 2009 from Broken Sea Productions. www.brokensea.com.
And now it's time for the Broken Sea Audio Production OTR Swag Cast.
From the NBC University Theater, a first radio production of the most challenging novel of 1949, George Orwell's 1984. Our star, Mr. David Niven. Herewith, a disturbing broadcast. A dramatization by Milton Wayne of George Orwell's 1984. In his current and very widely discussed novel, Mr. Orwell has projected the totalitarian techniques abroad in the world today to their terrible extreme. The plight of the individual in this world, we leave you to assess for yourselves as you listen to the story of Mr. Winston Smith, portrayed today by the internationally known British actor, David Niven. At intermission, we will bring you a commentary on Mr. Orwell's writing by another distinguished author, Mr. James Hilton. Here, then, is David Niven in George Orwell's 1984.
The clocks of London are striking 13. On this cold April day, you hurry to escape the vile wind. You slip quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with you. The hallway smells of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, an enormous colored poster with a man's face more than 3 feet wide. The face, a ruggedly handsome 45 with a heavy black mustache.
Big brother is watching you.
What's that?
Look, no need to jump like that, Mr. Smither. I was just reading off what it says on that poster.
Oh, of course.
7 flights up to your flat. It's slow going for you, Winston Smith. Frail and underweight and 39 and tormented by a varicose ulcer above your right ankle. who have to rest several times on the way. On each landing, the poster with the enormous face looks down on you, and the eyes follow you.
Big Brother is watching you.
Everywhere, from every wall, from every building.
Big Brother is watching you.
You're in your flat, but you are not alone. You are never alone.
That the total production of pig iron is 58,328,912 tons.
The voice comes from an oblong metal plaque like a dulled mirror which forms part of the surface of the right-hand wall. You turn a switch and the voice sinks somewhat. But there is no way of shutting it off completely. The telescreen receives and transmits simultaneously. So long as you remain in its field of vision, you can be seen as well as heard. And there is no way of knowing when the thought police might plug in on your wire. There is no way of knowing. You move over to the window.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
You stand at your window and you look down. You think with a vague distaste.
This is London. This, the chief city of Airstrip 1, the third most populous of the provinces of Oceania. Was it always like this? Always these rotting houses, their windows patched with cardboard, their roofs with corrugated iron, their crazy garden walls sagging in all directions? Was it always? When I was a child, but I can't remember. I can't remember. I never can.
You turn quickly from the window, and you go to the table in the small alcove where you are cut off from being seen by the telescreen. Quickly you take the secretly bought notebook, the archaic penpoint and holder out of the drawer. What you are about to do can mean death.
It's not illegal to keep a diary. Nothing is illegal since there are no more laws. But if the thought police find out, it's death. Or at least 25 years in a forced labor camp.
You ink the pen, and you falter for just a second. A tremor goes through you.
I must start. I must mark the paper. April 4th, 1984. But how do I know? How can I be certain that that is 1984? No, it must be. I'm fairly sure that I'm 39. I believe I was born in 1944 or 45. But it's never possible nowadays to pin down any date within a year or two. But what difference does it make? How can I speak to the future? If it's like the present, no one will listen. If it's different, how will they understand the things happening now? I mustn't think about it. I must begin now. April 4th. Last night to the flicks, all war films, one of a ship full of refugees being bombed somewhere in the Mediterranean. Audience, much amused by a shot of a helicopter firing at a man swimming away. He was full of holes. The sea around him turned pink. Audience shouting with laughter when he sank. And then you saw a lifeboat full of children with a helicopter over him.
You write on, wildly ridding your mind of painful memory. But as you write, another memory comes clear in your mind. It happened during the 2 minutes hate period at the ministry that very morning. After the chant of loyalty to Big Brother, Winston Smith noticed O'Brien, the big man wearing glasses and the black overalls of the powerful inner party. That morning, O'Brien had turned and his eyes had met Winston's. Winston knew that O'Brien was thinking the same thing as himself. It was as if O'Brien were saying,
I am with you. I know all about your contempt, your hatred, your disgust. But don't worry. I am on your side.
Then O'Brien's face was as inscrutable as everybody else's. But even that was a memorable event in the locked loneliness in which one had to live.
Down with Big Brother. Down with Big Brother. I'll fill the page with it or the whole book. Makes no difference now. The thought police will get me just the same. Even if I never put the pen to paper, I have committed thought crime. And for that, they're bound to get you. Sooner or later, but they'll get you. Always, during the night, you simply disappear. Your name removed from the registers. Every record of you wiped out. You were abolished, annihilated, vaporized. They'll shoot me in the back. I don't care. Down with Big Brother. They overshoot you in the back of the neck. I don't care. Down with Big Brother.
Already?
You sit still.
Maybe they'll go away. The worst thing would be to delay. You get up and you move heavily toward the door.
Oh, comrade, do you think you could come across and have a look at our kitchen sink? It's got blocked up and...
I'll see what I can do, Mrs. Parsons.
I'm sorry to bother you. Of course, it's only because Tom isn't home.
Amid the clutter of the flat, you notice the banners of the Youth League and the spies on the wall, and a full-size poster of Big Brother.
Don't mind the looks of the place. It's the children. They haven't been out today.
Have you got a spanner?
A spanner? I don't know. Perhaps the children...
Up with your hands!
The tough-looking boy springs at you with a pointed toy automatic pistol. He is dressed in the uniform of the spies.
Higher! Get them up higher!
Is this high enough?
You're a traitor! You're a thought criminal!
Freddy, please let Mr. Smith fix the thing.
He's a traitor or a thought criminal!
Oh, he and his sister are disappointed because they couldn't go to the park to see the hanging of the Eurasian war prisoners.
Why can't we go? All the other children are going.
Take you next time.
Oh, that won't be for another month.
There, Mrs. Parsons, I think that does it.
Thank you, comrade. Say thank you, Freddy.
I will not. He's a traitor. He's a follower of Goldstein.
You go to the window. Down in the street, the wind flaps a torn poster with the word Ingsoc. You stand watching.
The three sacred principles of Ingsoc. New speak, double think, the mutability of the past. What past? The past is dead. The future is unimaginable. I am alone, lost in a monstrous world. What living human creature is on my side? How do I know that the power of the party won't endure forever?
Like an answer, the three slogans on the white face of the Ministry of Truth come back to you.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
The telescreen strikes. You have to leave in 10 minutes to be back at your work at 14:30. You see the diary on the table.
Who am I writing it for? Only the thought police will read it before they wipe it out of existence and out of memory. But there are things I must say or I can't stay sane.
You go back to the table, dip your pen, and write.
To the future or to the past. To a time when thought is free, when men are different one from another and do not live alone. To a time when truth exists and what is done cannot be undone. From the age of uniformity, from the age of solitude, from the age of Big Brother, from the age of doublethink, greetings. I am already dead, for I am committing thought crime, and thought crime is death.
You're just the man I was looking for.
Well, what can I do for you, Sime?
Tell me, have you got any razor blades?
Not one. I've been using the same for 6 weeks.
Keep an eye moving. Next, please.
Did you go and see the prisoners hanged yesterday?
I was working. I'll see it on the fix, I suppose.
A very inadequate substitute. It's a good hanging, Smith. I think it spoils it when they tie their feet together.
Next, please.
Oh, there's a table over there under the telescreen. Let's pick up a gin on the way.
Sime, how's that dictionary of new speak getting on?
Slowly. I'm on the adjectives. It's fascinating.
It must be quite a job inventing new words.
Oh, that's not our chief job at all. We're destroying words. What sense is there in having a whole string of useless vague words like excellent and splendid and all the rest of them? Plus good covers the meaning. Or double plus good if you want something stronger still. Don't you see the beauty of that, Winston? It was B.B.'s idea originally, of course.
Well, I know that, Sime, one of Big Brother's most revolutionary ideas.
Oh, it's not just words. In the end, we shall make thought crime impossible, because there will be no words in which to express it. Has it ever occurred to you, Winston, that by the year 2050, not a single human will be alive who could understand such a conversation as we're now having?
Oh, except the proletarians, of course.
Oh, the proletarians are not human beings. Proles and animals are free. The whole literature of the past will have been destroyed. Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Byron, they'll exist only in newspeak versions.
Then they'll be changed into something different?
Well, even the slogans of the party will change. How can you have a slogan like Freedom is slavery when the concept of freedom has been abolished. The whole climate of thought will be different. In fact, there will be no thought as we understand it now.
Hello, 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 hello. Mind if I sit down?
Not at all, Parsons.
By the way, old boy, I hear a little beggar of mine gave you a rough time yesterday.
I think he was a little upset at not going to the execution.
Oh, well, shows the right spirit, doesn't it? Oh, by the way, do you know what that little girl of mine did last Saturday when the troop was on a hike out Berkhamsted way? She got two other girls to go with her and spent the whole afternoon following a strange man. And then, when they got to Amersham, handed him over to the patrols.
What did they do that for?
Ah! My kid made sure he was some enemy agent. Might have been got by parachute. Pretty smart for a nipper of seven, eh?
What happened to the man?
That I couldn't say, of course, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was now an unperson.
Oh, good. Of course, we can't afford to take chances.
Oh, what I mean to say is, there's a war on. Suppose you don't have any razor blades you can let me have?
Hmm? Not one.
Mm. Thought I'd ask you, old boy.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's back to work, old boy.
You sit in your flat, listening to the telescreen voice. The diary is open before you, but you are not writing. Once again, you feel the protest in your stomach, in your skin. The feeling that you've been cheated of something that you had a right to. You try, but you can't remember anything different. You turn to writing in your diary.
How can I know what used to be? There is the party slogan. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. The party can thrust its hand into the past and say of this or that event, it never happened. And this is more terrifying than mere torture and death. The party says, reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It is the final, most essential command. Maybe I'm a lunatic. Perhaps a lunatic is simply a minority of one. But the obvious, the silly, the true, has got to be defended. The solid world exists. Stones are hard. Water is wet. Objects unsupported fall towards the earth's center. Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. If that is granted, all else follows.
Dangerous thing you're doing now. You've walked for several miles through the proletarian section where the thought police would have many questions to ask if they found you. Now you find yourself inside the junk store where you had bought the diary.
I recognized you on the pavement. You're the gentleman that bought the keepsake album.
I was passing, I just looked in. I don't want anything in particular, Mr. Charrington.
Nah, it's just as well, because I don't suppose I could have satisfied you. Between you and me, the antique trade's just about finished. Now, there's another room upstairs that you might care to see.
You lived here at one time?
Until my wife died. Now, don't you think this is a quiet, cozy room?
There's no telescreen.
I never had one of those things. Now, if you happen to be interested in old prints, here, sir. The frame's fixed to the wall, but I could unscrew it for you, I dare say.
I know that building, Mr. Charrington. It's a ruin now, It's in the middle of the street outside the Palace of Justice.
That's right, sir. It was a church at one time. St. Clement's Dane, its name was. Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement's.
What's that?
That was a rhyme we had when I was a little boy. A full 60 years ago.
How does it go on?
I don't remember, but I do know how it ended up. Here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head. It was a kind of dance. And when they came to, here comes a chopper to chop off your head, they brought their arms down and caught you. It was just the names of churches. All the London churches were in it. All the principal ones, that is.
I never knew it had been a church.
Oh, there's lots of them left, really, though they've been put to other uses. How did the rhyme go? Ah, I've got it. You owe me 3 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. There now. That's as far as I can get. A farthing. That was a small copper coin. Looked something like a cent.
Where was St. Martin's?
That's still standing in Victoria Square. It's the building where they have the models of the rock bombets and the floating fortresses and the pictures of enemy atrocities. St. Martin's in the Fields, it used to be called.
Relieved, Mr. Charrington. You should never have come back here without knowing if the old man could be trusted. You start down the street. You'll come back to buy the engraving of St. Clement's Dane and carry it home, hidden under the jacket of your overalls. And you'll even drag the rest of the poem out of Mr. Charrington's memory.
Oranges and lemons, say the bell tolls and clang. You owe me 3 farthings, say the...
Suddenly, your heart turns to ice. A figure in blue overalls is coming toward you. A dark-haired girl in her 20s. The narrow scarlet sash of the Junior Anti-Sex League is wound around her waist. You know her, but you've never spoken to her. She looks straight into your face, and then walks on quickly as though she hadn't seen you. For a few seconds, you're too paralyzed to move. Then you turn and walk heavily away.
It's at night they come for you. Always at night. The proper thing is to kill yourself before they get you. And they'll get you. Once you've succumbed to thought crime, you're dead.
From Hollywood, the NBC University Theater is bringing you David Niven in a radio version of George Orwell's 1984. And now, our intermission commentator, the distinguished author, Mr. James Hilton.
George Orwell is a distinguished English writer who is desperately concerned, as many others of us are today, with the shape of things to come. And he is also aware that such earlier prophecies as those of Mr. Wells and Mr. Aldous Huxley were not so much incorrect as incomplete, and are now in need of restatement and revision before a modern audience. Thus, Mr. Wells forecasts the engulfment of modern civilization in total war. But war, says Mr. Orwell, is not all, nor is it quite the worst imaginable thing. And as long ago as 1932, Mr. Huxley satirized the regimented state in his book called Brave New World. But some people in those days probably missed the satire, and thought that with all its mass production techniques and scientific management, Mr. Huxley's New World might even be worth looking forward to. But today, no one is so naive as that. Indeed, the crisis of our civilization is in some danger of becoming a cliché for after-dinner speakers. Mr. Orwell, however, is the first writer to warn us in the form of fictional satire what might conceivably happen if all the worst features that exist anywhere in our modern world were to prevail over all the others, and if, in addition, all these worst features were to spread all over the earth. Since the story is told with nightmarish detail and inexorable logic, the commentator can perhaps serve best by a few mild warnings of his own. First, that despite any easy assumptions that might readily and even excusably occur to both listener and reader, Mr. Orwell's satire does not bear exclusively against any one country. Certain early symptoms of that breakdown of the human soul which he forecasts are diagnosable in all countries today. And most of us also, to a greater or less extent, are already victims of certain types of doublethink. And it would be a useful private exercise to examine near home for such instances, as well as to recognize them more spectacularly in other parts of the world. Personally, I find Mr. Orwell's picture horrible and timely and fascinating. It will probably take its place among the memorable works of its kind, both for its technical virtuosity and for a sort of intellectual passion that pervades it throughout. Mr. Orwell is, as we say, burned up about the state of the world, but the fuel of that fire is not only in the world, but in his own mind. This is what makes the satirist at all times and in all ages, and it's why, having read Mr. Orwell's 1984, you may not feel you'd like to meet any of its characters, but you do feel you'd like to meet Mr. Orwell, if only for an argument. Outside of literature, however, it might be said that 1984 suffers from a philosophic flaw inherent in all such prophetic fiction. It does not allow for the fact that history is not an exact science, perhaps not even a science at all, and that any equation of the future is bound to contain many variables. And yet, with all the reservations some of us might make, this book that Mr. Orwell has written deserves our serious attention. It is not a likable story, and one may hope and even believe that it is not a likely story either. But When we think of all that has happened throughout the world during our own lifetimes, it does not seem quite an impossible story.
Thank you, Mr. Hilton.
It's the middle of the morning. You've left the work cubicle to go to the lavatory. A solitary figure comes toward you from the other end of the long, brightly lit corridor. It's the girl with the dark hair. 4 days ago, you ran into her outside the junk shop. She's about 10 feet from you.
Oh, are you hurt?
Nothing. My arm. I'll be all right in a second.
Haven't broken anything?
No, I'm all right. It just hurt for a moment, that's all.
Here, let me help you up.
Thanks. I'll be all right. I only gave my wrist a bit of a bang. Thanks, comrade.
She walks off briskly. While you were helping her up, she slipped something into your hand. Scrap of paper folded into a square. You will open it when you are away from the telescreens in the corridor and in the lavatory.
Whatever's on the paper, it must have some kind of political meaning. She's an agent of the Thought Police. They have reasons for the message. Maybe a threat, a summons, an order to commit suicide, a trap. Maybe not that at all. Maybe a note from an underground organization. Perhaps the Brotherhood exists after all. No, absurd. The message means only one thing.
10 minutes later, in your cubicle, you open it. In a large, unformed handwriting.
I love you.
It's hard to conceal your agitation from the telescreen.
I've got to get in touch with her. Arrange a meeting somewhere. But I don't know her name or where she lives. I can't follow her home. That would mean loitering outside the ministry, bound to be noticed. There's one place. The canteen. At a table by herself, not too near the telescreen. With a chatter of conversation all around. For only 30 seconds. For only a few words.
A week goes by. At last it happens. You both sit eating the watery stew. You continue eating, you don't look up.
What time do you leave work?
18:30.
Where can we meet?
Victory Square, near the monument.
Full of telescreens.
Doesn't matter if there's a crowd.
Any signal?
No. Don't come up until you see me among a lot of people. And don't look at me. Just keep somewhere near me.
What time?
19 hours.
All right.
Afternoon or...
Yes.
Then listen carefully. Go to Paddington Station. Take train 14 to Fenchurch. Turn left outside the station and you'll come to a gate with a top bar missing. Go across that field to a track between bushes. Stay on that until you come to a dead tree with moss on it. Can you remember that?
Yes.
You turn left, then right, then left again. And the gate's got no top bar.
Yes, what time?
About 15. You may have to wait. I'll get there by another way. Are you sure you remember everything?
Yes.
Then get away from me as quick as you can. Here we are. I didn't want to say anything in the lane, in case there was a mic hidden there. We're all right here, though.
I didn't meet any patrols. I watched for them all the way from the station.
Oh, we're safe here. What are you grinning at?
Would you believe that till this moment, I didn't know the color of your eyes. Now that you've seen what I'm really like, can you still bear to look at me?
Yes, easily.
I'm 39 years old. I've got a wife I can't get rid of. I've got varicose veins, and I've got 5 false teeth.
I couldn't care less.
Darling.
Darling, precious, oh my dearest, dearest love. We've got the whole afternoon. Isn't it?
What's your name?
Julia. I know yours. It's Winston. Winston Smith.
How did you find that out?
I expect I'm better at finding out things than you are, dear. Tell me, what did you think of me before that day I gave you the note?
I hated the sight of you. I wanted to hurt you, murder you. If you really want to know, I imagine that you had something to do with the thought police.
Oh, no. Not the thought police.
Well, perhaps not exactly that, but from your general appearance, merely because you're young and fresh and healthy, I thought that probably...
You thought I was a good party member. And you also thought that if I had a quarter of a chance, I'd denounce you as a thought criminal and get you killed off.
Yes, something of that kind. Well, a great many young girls are like that, you know.
It's bloody sash that does it. Wait, I'll rip the thing off. There. Have a piece of chocolate.
Where did you get this?
Black market.
You're very young. 10 years younger than I am. What could attract you in a man like me?
As soon as I saw you, I knew you were against them. Against the party. Against the bloody rotten swine in the inner party.
Julia, listen. I'm against the purity the party preaches and the goodness. I don't want any virtue to exist anywhere. I want everyone to be corrupt to the bones.
Well, then, I ought to suit you, dear. I'm corrupt to the very bones.
You never go back to the clearing in the wood. You and Julia can meet only in the streets, in a different place every evening, and never for more than a half hour at a time. You don't even discuss the possibility of getting married. No committee would sanction it, even if Catherine could somehow be gotten rid of. It's hopeless, even as a daydream.
What was she like, your wife?
She was, the newspeak word, good thinkful, meaning naturally orthodox, incapable of thinking a bad thought.
I know the kind of person, right enough. Everything is always our duty to the party.
How do you know that?
I've been at school too, dear. Why didn't you shove her off the cliff? I would have.
Perhaps if I'd been the same person I am now.
Are you sorry you didn't?
Yes. On the whole, I'm sorry I didn't. But it doesn't really matter. In this game we're playing, we can't win. We are the dead.
We're not dead yet.
Not physically. 6 months, a year, 5 years conceivably. I'm afraid of death. You're young, so you're more afraid of it. Put it off as long as we can, but it makes very little difference.
Oh, rubbish. Don't you enjoy being alive? Look, darling, I'm real. I'm solid. Alive. Don't you like that?
Yes, I like that.
Stop talking about dying, then. Where shall we meet next time?
Julia, I've rented the room for Mr. Charrington.
Sooner or later we'll be caught.
I know, it's madness.
Yes. Wait for me there, day after tomorrow. Wait. Just let me show you what I've brought. Look here. Go on. Go on, open it.
Sugar.
Real, not saccharine. And here, a loaf of white bread. But look, this is the one I'm really proud of.
Coffee. Real coffee.
There's a whole kilo here.
How'd you manage to get hold of all these things?
Oh, it's all in a party stuff. And look, I've got a little packet of tea, too.
Real tea, not blackberry leaves.
There's been a lot of tea about lately. They captured India or something. But listen, dear, I want you to turn your back on me for a bit. And don't turn around till I tell you. You can turn around now. Well?
Beautiful. I've never seen a woman of the party with cosmetics on her face. And scent, too.
Yes, dear. And scent, too. And do you know what I'm going to do next? I'm going to get hold of a real woman's frock. And silk stockings and high heels. Oh, darling, in this room, I'm going to be a woman. Not a party comrade. A woman. I'll make some coffee in another moment. We've still got an hour. What time do they cut the lights off at your flats?
23:30.
It's 23 at the hospital. Hi! Get out of there, you filthy brute!
What was it?
A rat. With beastly nose. Oh, there's a hole down there.
Rats? In this room?
Ah, oh, they're all over. Some parts of London are just swarming with them. A woman daren't leave a baby alone for 2 minutes. It's the great huge brown ones that do it, and the brutes always
come. Don't go on!
Darling, what's the matter?
Oh, of all the horrors in the world, a rat!
Oh, no, darling, no. Now, don't worry. We're not going to have the filthy brutes in here. I'll stuff the hole before we go. Oh, come on. Help me make the coffee. Darling, I've been meaning to ask you. That picture over there on the wall, would that be about 100 years old?
More. 200, I dare say. I can't tell. It's impossible to discover the age of anything nowadays.
What is that place? I've seen it before somewhere.
A church, or at least it used to be. St. Clement's Dane, its name was. Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement.
You owe me 3 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. I can't remember how it goes after that. But anyway, I remember it ends up, here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head.
Who taught you that?
My grandfather. He was vaporized when I was 8. I wonder what a lemon was.
Oh, I can remember lemons. They were quite common in the 50s. They were so sour, it set your teeth on edge even to smell them.
Oh, dear. I suppose it's almost time we were leaving. I should start washing this paint off. I'll get the lipstick off your face afterwards.
It happens at last. The expected message comes. We're walking down the long corridor of the ministry. You turn around. So, Brian.
I was reading one of your Newspeak articles the other day. You take a scholarly interest in Newspeak, I believe.
Well, hardly scholarly. I'm only an amateur. I never had anything to do with the construction of the language.
But you write it very elegantly. Have you seen the 10th edition of the Newspeak Dictionary?
No, I didn't think it had been issued yet.
A few advance copies have been circulated. I have one myself. It might interest you to look at it, perhaps.
Yes, very much so.
Some of the new developments are most ingenious. Let me see. Perhaps you could pick it up at my flat sometime that suited you. Wait. Let me give you my address.
Julia, darling, it was like a message, as if O'Brien was saying, if you ever want to see me, this is where I can be found.
But he's an important member of the inner party, dear. If it's a trap...
Darling, this is part of something that happened years ago. First, it was a secret involuntary thought. Then I started a diary. I've moved from thoughts to words, and now from words to action.
Where will it end?
In the ministry of love. I've accepted that. The end was contained in the beginning. Has it ever occurred to you that the best thing for us to do would be simply to walk out of here before it's too late and never see each other again?
Yes, dear. It's occurred to me several times. But I'm not going to do it all the same.
We've been lucky. It can't last much longer.
What you do, I'm going to do.
We'll be together for another 6 months, a year. There's no knowing. At the end, we're certain to be apart. Do you realize how utterly alone we shall be? When once they get hold of us, there's nothing. Nothing either of us can do for the other. If I confess, they'll shoot you. If I don't, they'll shoot you just the same. Neither of us will even know whether the other is alive or dead. The one thing that matters is that we shouldn't betray one another. Although, even that can't make the slightest difference.
Everybody always confesses. You can't help it. They torture you.
Oh, I don't mean confessing. Confession is not betrayal. What you say or do doesn't matter. Only feelings matter. If they could mean you, that would be the real betrayal.
They can't do that. They can make you say anything, anything, but they can't make you believe it. They can't get inside of you.
No, that's quite true. They can't get inside you. If you can feel that staying human is worthwhile, even when it can't have any result whatever, then you've beaten them.
Darling, whenever it is you go to O'Brien, I'm going with you.
Just a moment.
You can turn it off.
Yes, Winston. We have that privilege. Well, shall I say it or will you?
I'll say it. That thing is really turned off?
Yes. Everything is turned off. We're alone.
All right. We have come here because we believe that there is some kind of secret conspiracy, some kind of secret organization working against the party and that you are involved in it. We want to join it and work for it. We are enemies of the party. We disbelieve in the principles of Ingsoc. We are thought criminals. We are also adulterers. I tell you this because we want to put ourselves at your mercy.
Yes. First, let us all take a drink.
I think it's fitting that we should begin by drinking a health. To our leader, to Emmanuel Goldstein.
Then there is such a person as Goldstein?
Yes, and he's alive. Well, I don't know.
And the conspiracy, the organization, it is real? It's not simply an invention of the thought police?
No, it's real. The Brotherhood, we call it. You'll never know much more about it than that it exists, and that you belong to it. I'll come back to that presently. Now for the matter. What are you prepared to do?
Anything we are capable of.
You are prepared to give your lives?
Yes.
To commit murder?
Yes.
To commit acts of sabotage which may cost the death of hundreds of innocent people?
Yes.
To cheat? To forge? To blackmail? To corrupt the minds of children? To distribute habit-forming drugs? To do anything which is likely to weaken the power of the party?
Yes.
You are prepared to commit suicide if and when we order it?
Yes.
You are prepared, the two of you, to separate and never see one another again?
No.
No. You did well to tell me. You understand that you'll be fighting in the dark. Later, I shall send you a book from which you will learn the true nature of the society we live in and the strategy by which we shall destroy it.
Not only this, but I cannot tell you. You get used to living without results,
without hope. We are the dead. Our only true life is in the future. Do you carry a briefcase to work?
As a rule, yes.
What is it like?
Oh, black, very shabby, two straps.
Good. One day soon in the street, a man will touch you on the arm and say, I think you've dropped your briefcase. The one he gives you will contain a copy of Goldstein's book. You'll return it within 14 days.
You must leave in a couple of minutes.
We shall meet again. If we do meet again.
In the place where there is no darkness?
In the place where there is no darkness. In the meantime, is there anything you wish to say before you leave? Any question?
Yes. Did you ever hear an old rhyme that begins, oranges and lemons, little bells of St. Clement?
Yes, Winston. Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement. You owe me 3 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. When will you pay me, say the bells of Old Bailey? When I get rich, say the bells of Shoreditch.
You knew the last line.
Yes, I knew the last line. Now I'm afraid it's time for you to go.
I've got the book. We must read it. You too. All members of the Brotherhood have to read it.
You read it aloud. That's the best way. Then you can explain it to me as you go.
The new movements which appeared in the middle years of the century, Ingsoc in Oceania, Neo-Bolshevism in Eurasia, death worship in East Asia, had the conscious aim of perpetuating unfreedom and inequality. The new movements grew out of the old ones. Even the names of the 4 ministries exhibit an impudence in their deliberate reversal of the facts. The Ministry of Peace concerns itself with war. The Ministry of Truth with lies. The Ministry of Love with torture, the Ministry of Plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental. They are deliberate exercises in double think. For it is only by reconciling.
Oh, I'm hungry. Oh, darling, the stove's gone out. There's no oil.
Oh, we can get some for old Charrington, I expect.
Oh, gosh, it's cold in here.
Do you remember the thrush that sang to us that first day at the edge of the wood?
He wasn't singing to us. He was just singing.
No, not to us. We are the dead.
We are the dead.
You are the dead! You are the dead! It was behind the picture. Remain exactly where you are. Make no movement until you are ordered.
Now we can see you.
Now we can see you. Stand out in the middle of the room. Stand back to back. Clasp your hands behind your head. Do not touch one another! The house is surrounded.
I suppose you may as well say goodbye.
You may as well say goodbye. And by the way, while we are on the subject, here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head.
You don't know where you are. The windowless cell with white porcelain walls might be in the Ministry of Love. Concealed lamps flooded with a cold light. There's a low, steady humming sound. It is the place where there is no darkness.
Smith! 6079, Smith W. Hands out of the pocket in the cell.
There is a telescreen on each wall. You started to reach into your overalls for stray breadcrumbs. You haven't eaten since you were arrested.
Ampleforth.
Smith, you too?
What are you in for?
There is only one offense, is there not? Crime thought.
And you have committed it?
Apparently. We were producing a definitive edition of Kipling. I allowed the word God to remain at the end of a line. I couldn't help it. The rhyme was Rod. There are only 12 rhymes to Rod in the language. There was no other rhyme.
You know what time it is?
No, I don't. There's no difference between night and day in this place.
Stop talking in the cells!
Ampleforth, room 101.
Time passes. Your hunger grows. Prisoners, men and women, are brought into your cell and are taken out. To room 101. Then the cell door opens once again. O'Brien and a guard come in. You start to your feet. You forget the telescreen.
They got you, too.
They got me a long time ago. You knew this, Winston. You've always known it. Guard?
Oh!
With that blow, the nightmare starts, and you confess to anything and everything. The confessions are a formality. The torture is real. And it goes on and on and on and on. Now you're lying strapped to a table. You can't move. There's a strong light falling in your face. O'Brien is standing at your side. On the other side, a man in a white coat holding a hypodermic syringe.
I told you that we met here again.
Yes, would
you? Oh! That's only a sample of what I can do by turning this dial. Remember that. If you lie to me, you will cry out of pain instantly. Do you understand that?
Yes.
I'm taking trouble with you, Winston, because you are worth trouble. You suffer from a defective memory. Fortunately, it is curable. There's a party slogan dealing with the control of the past. Repeat it, if you please.
Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past.
Good. Is it your opinion, Winston, that the past has any real existence?
No.
Then where does the past exist, if at all?
In records, it's written down in the mind, in human memories.
But we, the party, control all records, and we control all memories. Then we control the past, do we not?
But how can you stop people remembering things? How can you control memory? You've not controlled mine.
On the contrary, you have not controlled it. That is what has brought you here. Do you remember writing in your diary, freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4? How many fingers am I holding up, Winston?
4.
And if the party says that it's not 4 but 5, then how many?
4.
How many fingers, Winston?
4.
How many fingers, Winston?
4. What else can I say? 4.
How many fingers, Winston?
4. Stop it. Stop it. 4.
How many fingers, Winston?
5.
You're lying. You still think there are 4. How many, please?
4. 5. 4. Anything you like. Stop it. Stop the pain. Stop.
You're a slow learner, Winston.
How can I help it? How can I help seeing what's in front of my eyes? 2 and 2 are 4.
Sometimes, Winston. Sometimes they are 5 or 3. Or all of them at once. You must try harder. It's not easy to become sane. It's not easy.
It goes on endlessly. The questions, the drugs, the questions, the torture machines. And...
Do you know where you are, Winston?
I don't know. I can guess. In the Ministry of love.
Do you know how long you've been here?
No, I think it's months.
And why do you imagine we bring people to this place?
To make them confess?
No, that's not the reason. Try again.
To punish them?
No. To cure you. To make you sane. The party is not interested in the overt act. The thought is all we care about. We do not merely destroy our enemies, we change them. What happens to you here is forever. Even if we choose to let you live out the natural term of your life, you can never escape from us. Holden, set the machine for 2,000.
Yes, comrade.
This time it won't hurt you, Winston. Keep your eyes fixed on mine. Now, how many fingers am I holding?
5.
You see 5?
Yes.
You see now that it's at any rate possible.
Yes.
Before we bring the session to an end, you can ask me a few questions if you choose. The machine is switched off. What is your first question?
What have you done with Julia?
She betrayed you, Winston. All her rebelliousness, her deceit, her folly, her dirty-mindedness, everything has been burnt out of her. It was a perfect invasion.
You tortured her?
Next question.
Does Big Brother exist?
Of course he exists. The party exists. Big Brother is the embodiment of the party.
Will Big Brother ever die?
Of course not. How could he die? Next question.
What is in room 101?
You know that, Winston. Everyone knows what's in room 101. Holton, the hypodermic. We have beaten you, Winston. We have broken you. Can you think of any single degradation that has not happened to you?
I have not betrayed Julia.
No. That is perfectly true. You have not betrayed me, Julia.
How soon will they shoot me?
It might be a long time. You're a difficult case. But don't give up hope. Everyone is cured sooner or later. In the end, we shall shoot you.
You're much better now. Weeks or months have passed, but you have no way of knowing. And one day O'Brien is in your cell. With him are the guards.
Get up, Winston. Come here. You've had thoughts of deceiving me. Stand up straighter. Look me in the face. Tell me, Winston. And remember, no lies. Tell me, what are your true feelings toward Big Brother?
I hate him.
You hate it.
Good.
Then the time has come for you to take the last step. You must love Big Brother. It is not enough to obey him, you must love him. Guard, take him. Room 101.
You're strapped upright in a chair, so tightly that you can move nothing, not even your head. There are two small tables in front of you. For a moment, you're alone. Then O'Brien comes in.
Winston, you asked me once what was in room 101. Everyone knows the answer. The thing that is in room 101 is the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world varies from individual to individual. It may be death by fire, by drowning, by impalement, or 50 other deaths. In your case, it happens to be rats. Here. I placed the cage on the table so you can see them.
Well, you can't do that. You couldn't. It's impossible, O'Brien. You know this isn't necessary. What do you want me to do?
For everyone, there is something unendurable. Courage and cowardice are not involved. For you, the unendurable is rats. They're a form of pressure you cannot withstand. You will do what is required of you.
But what is it? What is it? How can I do it if I don't know what it is? No, don't bring him any closer.
You understand the construction of this cage. This mask will fit over your head, leaving no other exit. When I press this lever, these starving brutes will leap at your face. Sometimes they attack the eyes.
No, no, don't put them closer. No, no, no. Do it to Julia. Do it to Julia, not to me. I don't care what you do to her. I'll stick up to the bones. Not me, Julia. Not me.
is the lonely hour of 15. Cafe is almost empty. You sit at your usual place, drinking victory gin and studying the chess problems and the times. Nobody pays any attention to you. You've even seen Julia again. There was no danger in it. On a cold, biting March day, you had come across her in the park.
I betrayed you.
I betrayed you.
Sometimes they threaten you with something. Something you can't even think about. Then you don't care. You want it to happen to the other person. And that's what you keep shouting. All you care about is yourself.
All you care about is yourself.
You don't feel the same toward the other person any longer.
No, you don't feel the same. What happens to you there is forever. Something is burned out. We must meet again.
Yes. We must meet again.
Now in the dust on the cafe table, your finger traces unconsciously 2 + 2 = 5. And on the wall, Big Brother gazes down at you from a poster. You gaze up at the enormous face. 40 years it has taken you to learn what kind of smile is hidden beneath the dark mustache. Oh, cruel, needless misunderstanding. Oh, stubborn, self-willed exile from the loving breast. 2 gin-soaked tears trickle down the sides of your nose. It's all right. Everything is all right. The struggle is finished. You have won the victory over yourself.
I love you, Big Brother.
You have been listening to 1984, an NBC University Theater production of the novel by George Orwell, starring David Niven. From London, we present Orbit 10. A play in 6 episodes by Peter Elliott Hayes. Episode 4, The Voices.
This is Tom Lambert again. You've now heard 3 of the 6 tape recordings made by Dr. Hayward Petrie. But on that November night in the college laboratory, when the green rod went into action for the second time, we were very far from halfway to the truth. Even as the 3 of them watched a solid steel lamp dwindle and vanish into the cylinder, they could not dream of what was yet to come. But Dr. Petrie must take up the story for himself. Here is the 4th recording.
Continuation of notes, reel 4. If I had watched it alone, I would have disbelieved my own eyes. But we all saw it. That heavy, jointed lamp shrink to a speck and then literally suck into the glowing core of the rod. Almost at once, the disturbance, noise, light, vibration began to subside.
Look, do you see? The light's dimming.
And the mist in the cubicle is clearing. But there's no way for it to get out.
It doesn't need a way out. It's being reabsorbed into the rod where it came from.
Nothing else in there. The lamp's gone completely.
And we wondered what power that thing possessed. Now we know.
Yes.
It can absorb solid matter.
No.
Those objects missing from the shelf are Kirkuish.
Of course.
The way the workbench that thing was standing on seemed to vanish. The dust that was left, they went. The same way as that lamp.
But it's impossible. Solids, gases can't pass through each other. It's a question of densities. It's a law of physics.
Well, one of our laws, perhaps. But must they apply everywhere? Under sufficient pressure, water can be forced through a steel plate.
A solid can pass through a gas, but a splinter of superfrozen hydrogen can be driven into a wooden board. It's all a question of applied forces. We only understand these things in our own terms.
Yes, sir, but physical and chemical changes always leave something, some deposit.
Yes.
Look at the rod now. It's gone quite dull. You can see through it again.
They can.
Just the wires and the gray thing in the center. Nothing else.
No, nothing else.
But that lamp just can't disappear off the face of the earth.
Can't it? After tonight, who are we to say what's impossible? Thank heaven we had that cabinet made. If this had happened in the open.
Yes.
It seems to work more powerfully each time.
Now listen, both of you. I repeat what I said 3 days ago, and this time I mean it. After this, we must never open that cubicle, not for any reason.
No.
All right.
If solid matter can be drawn in, it could be, well, extremely dangerous.
Doctor?
Yes?
The book I was looking at, before Cliff founded the buzzer. That illustration, I think you're right.
Yes, that organism in the center, it has all the same characteristics, only on a much larger scale. The resemblance is perfect.
And the photograph was of human nerve cells.
Yes, each one perhaps 1/10,000th of an inch in diameter. But the cells that thing is made up of must be 1/4 of an inch across. If that material comes from some kind of living being, for some reason, in some way, enclosed, sealed in, the mind staggers at the possibilities. Don't you realize it's simply a question of scale? A human, if he were composed of cells that size, would be... he'd be almost 3 miles high. Later that night, leaving Clifford and Elizabeth on watch, I went alone to my study. I wanted to think. This had suddenly become something far larger than a laboratory problem. This powerful, ruthless mechanism, lying buried for years beneath a Hebridean beach with the sea washing indifferently over it, how had it got there, and more vital, where had it begun its existence? At last, I picked up the telephone and called Sir Edward Bancroft at his home in Kent. Edward made no comment as I told him the facts. When I'd finished, he told me to come down to Westrum at once and bring my students with me. I wonder now if either of us realized that it was 3 in the morning. I shall always remember that drive through the wet, empty suburbs and later through the black Surrey lanes. And at 4:30, we were sitting in Edward's panel drawing room around the ashes of a dead fire with the first grey of dawn coming over the Kent hills.
You were the pajamas and dressing gown, weren't you?
Yes,
sir. Don't usually receive guests like this. But guests usually come at a respectable hour.
Well, Ed, sorry.
My wife's making coffee. She'll be here in a minute.
Perhaps I should have waited until the morning.
No, you did quite right, Heyman. Well, at least you didn't write off the college completely.
Not quite.
And these are the readings you collected.
Yes, sir.
Radiation level reached 5 runchens. Temperature down to -11 in 80 seconds. Vibrations up to 12,000 cycles. Quite a lively little gadget, isn't it?
And we lost a lamp.
Yes. Look, Hayward, it's no good our thinking up glib explanations and sticking our heads in the sand. I'm in touch with technological advances pretty well everywhere, and I can tell you that no one has produced anything like this. So, we're forced to consider the possible alternative.
That the cylinder did not originate on this planet.
Not a new idea to you, perhaps.
No, it's not.
We've shot umpteen satellites into space. Some of them have stayed up.
Some of them haven't.
But what do we know about what comes into our own planetary back garden? Practically nothing.
I agree.
This could be our first contact with some other intelligence.
Yes.
The thing probably isn't meant to do any harm. It may be just a complex instrument hopelessly out of its element running wild. Imagine Sputnik 99 thumping down on Venus and disgorging sparks, radio signals, and guinea pigs. The inhabitants, if any, would be quite justified in taking a sledgehammer to it and asking questions afterwards. This could be something like that.
Yes, but where in the solar system could it have come from? The composition of the planets is well known. None of them can support the kind of life to bring off an achievement like this.
And I think, sir, our cylinder can bite a little harder than the average guinea pig.
It can.
And it'll take more than a sledgehammer to even chip it.
Yes, so you've seen.
We have indeed.
Well, None of us is qualified to make decisions on this. In the morning, I shall give Charles a ring.
Charles?
Lord Heatherton, the Minister of Science.
Oh, of course.
Lives in Whitehall somewhere. We're getting a little out of our depth, Hayward. I'm afraid officialdom must take over.
Yes, whatever happens, I must have facilities to continue studying that rod. I can't stop now.
Well, I know, Charles, you have every facility. And the cylinder for the moment seems safe enough where it is.
Oh.
Don't look so glum, all of you. You may have made the most important discovery in the history of our world.
Oh, I hope so, Edward, but I don't know. I just wish there wasn't something about that thing that makes me want to throw it back into the sea.
That's not like you, Hayward. You're tired. Been going at it too hard.
Perhaps.
We must take this one careful step at a time. Ah, here's that copy. Yes, poor old Heatherton. Cambridge, he was just rotten at high on that.
I reached home as my housekeeper was laying breakfast. If my unshaven, disheveled appearance was a shock for her, there was one waiting for me, too. Almost at once, the telephone rang. Oh, Cardiff University? Yes, this is Dr. Petrie. Thank you. Hello? Good
morning, Hayward.
Morning.
Trevor Hughes here?
Good.
Did I get you out of bed?
No, you didn't.
Good, good.
How is West Wales this morning?
Cold and damp, but better than London any day. Hayward.
Yes?
You asked me to have a look at that colliery, Slan Wesleyan in the Rhondda.
Yes, of course. Now, have I wasted your time?
I got a group of my students doing some detecting, ones who come from that part.
Hold on.
I have a good mind to advise the dean to send them down, every mother's son of them.
Why, what have they done?
A couple of them were keen potholers. They thought this was too good to miss. Worse, one of them had worked in a pit.
Well?
They went to Slan Wesleyan, but everything seemed quiet enough, including the pit keeper who was having a sleep. Of course, there was no way of getting down the old shaft, but did that discourage them? The idiots went down their way. Potholing gear, ropes, lamps, and all the rest. They ought to be shot. Believe it or not, they got down to the level of the first working and went half a mile into the galleries.
Good for them.
Good for...
Foolhardy of them.
Mad as hatters.
Yes.
Luckily, the pit is still in quite good shape, except for a few small collapses and a little flooding. But at the very end of the east working, Hayward, they say they found a kind of cavern.
Oh, yes.
It must have formed since the pit was closed. And then, clambering about with their lamps, they found something else.
What? What did they find?
An object covered in mineral deposits sticking out of the debris. Tubular, 7 or 8 feet long. They described it as some sort of cylinder.
Oh. So it's not the only one. They didn't try to move it.
No, the air was foul. They had to come up.
Thank heaven for that. Now, Trevor, I can't explain it all now, but they must not go down again.
Yes.
We have a similar object here in the college.
What?
Yes, and we don't know what it may be.
Have you been climbing down coal mines at your age?
No. No, this was found on an island in the Hebrides. Now we know of two.
Good.
I'll call you later, Trevor.
All right, yes, yes.
And those students of yours...
Huh?
Be strict with them. Get them sent down, definitely.
Yes, I should, of course. On the other hand, one could say they showed a good sense of initiative. What are you laughing at?
Oh, nothing. Thanks for your help. Goodbye. Shortly afterwards, the telephone rang again. It was Sir Edward Bancroft. He told me he'd arranged an appointment for me with the Minister of Science, 4 o'clock that afternoon in Whitehall. A cloud of uncertainty was gathering in my mind, a dark, forbidding cloud. And I knew then where the answer lay. I went to Fleet Street, to Tom Lambert.
Well, Doctor, are we in business, or aren't we?
Yes. Lambert, I owe you an apology.
No, not at all.
You were right to drag me down to Van Wetland. After this, I'll respect journalistic intuition. There is another cylinder in that pit.
There is?
Yes. It was found yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a shot in the dark, but I've had my eye on this longer than you have, Doctor. You know, years ago, I began noticing the way similar reports kept turning up.
Yes?
Well, I hadn't a ghost of a theory for them, but once a journalist smells a mystery...
Oh, I know.
Well, anyway, I started a private news library.
Just so, and that's why I came.
Huh?
You showed me some cuttings on the train to Wales. There were about 7, I remember.
Yeah, but they were only a few of them.
A few?
Well, didn't I make that clear?
No. How many more are there?
You'd better see the file. All of it. It should be in here. And I've only been at this for a few years. Here we are.
Hmm.
Oh, it's very thick. Uh-huh. One cutting dated 1907. Mystery earth tremors in Lincolnshire. 1919, strike at Kent Quarry, narrow escapes as fissure opens. 1929, frostbite in midsummer, strange sounds on Exmoor.
And plenty more, going back for 50 years. 40 accounts in all.
40?
And they all have a familiar ring, don't they, Doctor? Maybe even this isn't the whole story. Look, turn to the last sheet. One I came across by accident when I was in Jordan last year.
Syrian village devastated. Humming heard as ground subsides. Green light. Vibration felt in Damascus. Good heavens.
Yeah. And early this year, a half-finished block of flats in Belgrade collapsed without warning. Again, the ground just caved in, and again, workmen talked about a green light. Does that mean anything?
Yes. Of course you would. You don't know, the cylinder in our laboratory emits a green light when it functions.
Good heavens.
Yes. Syria, Yugoslavia, there could be others, perhaps all over the world. Lambert, this is vitally important. All such reports everywhere. Can we get hold of them?
Tall order. The world's a fair-sized place, you know. Yeah, but the press association's not so little. If I can get my editor on our side, and the foreign news agencies would play, we can try.
I think I can get you official backing for it. I'm seeing Lord Heatherton this afternoon.
The minister? Is it that high already?
Yes. Look, may I borrow this file of yours? I think he ought to see it.
Yeah, it's all yours. And I just hope that one day that lot might make a news story.
It may yet.
Looks like something pretty big, doesn't it, Doctor?
Bigger, perhaps, than we can even imagine. Soon after 4 o'clock, I was sitting in a long, high room behind Whitehall. A log crackled in an Adam fireplace, its flames reflecting darkly on the disdainful portraits on the walls. Beyond the tall window, a tug hooted on the grey curve of the Thames. Lord Heatherton seemed a quiet, mild-looking man, until his blue eyes suddenly sharpened, and then you felt a powerful mental microscope focusing on him.
Interesting, Dr. Petrie, there. Disturbing, perhaps. But would you say conclusive, any of it?
Well, there's no actual proof of what we suspect.
Right, then you're not a crank.
No, sir.
Well, now, you've given me the technical data, your notes, methodical, as I expected they would be. And I've talked with Bancroft, and he takes it seriously. Now tell me what you think, Doctor. Just what you consider we are up against.
Well, I can summarize. We know of the certain existence of two cylinders. They can cause violent physical disturbances. They can also assimilate mineral and metallic substances. Probably any solid matter.
How do they do it? I want your theory.
Possibly by some means of compressing molecular structures. This could account for the extraordinary shrinking process we have observed. When the object is sufficiently condensed, it passes into the interior of the rod and is absorbed. You might say it's digested without trace.
But this is not limited to single objects.
No. Beneath the ground, the cylinders absorb quantities of whatever strata surround them, soil, rock, sand. Submerged, I believe they even take in seawater.
They seem to have quite an appetite. Mm. And some curious taste. But this would require energy, a great deal. Where do they obtain it?
It may well be that they can absorb that, too, from any nearby source. Dynamos, electric lines, possibly even heat. There was an occasion when an express diesel engine became drained of power. And at the college, since we've had the thing in the laboratory, the lights often grow dim, and the electric lifts work sluggishly.
You mean they can recharge themselves at will? Through solid walls, across distances?
It's the only answer. And when they're replenished, they can operate again. That's when the dangerous freezings occur.
I see. And these news reports, do you seriously believe that each one means another cylinder?
Well, not in every case, perhaps, but I think we must accept the existence of, well, a considerable number.
Europe, Middle East, a network of them. Where does one begin to grasp a thing like this? And you are trying to trace all reports that fit the known pattern.
Yes. It may take some time.
It must be done quickly. I will talk to the Press Association myself. Until we know how far this goes, if the results are significant, some of the sites will have to be excavated. Until then, carry on with your work, Doctor.
You'll have my ministry's full support.
Thank you, sir.
Money if you need it.
Thank you.
It's not meter readings I want. I want to know why. What their purpose is. And now, what is nowadays known as the $64,000 question. Where have they come from, Doctor? You tell me.
Very well. I believe they've traveled here from some source in space. They've been guided, directed to bury themselves in out-of-the-way places. They're part of a plan, an operation, devised by an extremely advanced intelligence. They've been falling on Earth for at least 50 years, possibly for very much longer. It seems safe to assume, therefore, that they're still arriving. It was coming nearer. At last we were beginning to glimpse the vast outline which only too soon was to become dreadfully clear. And things were not only happening in London. Since our return, we'd had too much to occupy us to give much thought to where it had all begun. The radio telescope on the Isle of Scala. But on that desolate headland in the control room beneath the huge brooding bowl, McCracken and Garrick were making discoveries of their own.
Still a long way from breaking down the signals themselves, but you check the calculations yourself, sir. What conclusion would you come to?
The signals faded steadily for 6 months. Now they're growing stronger again. The source moving away from us.
And coming back.
Yes. And these progressions are regular.
Yes.
That means the motion of the point of origin is curved. An arc.
And an arc is part of a circle.
Or an ellipse.
An ellipse.
And that can only mean one thing. An orbit.
Yes.
These transmissions are coming from a solid body orbiting around the sun like a planet. Somewhere beyond Pluto. Nine planets and... Peter, do you realize what this could be?
Yes, what every astronomer has been wondering since Pluto was discovered in 1930.
Yes. Well, the universities must see these figures and... No, I must discuss this with Petrie first. We need his opinion. I'll send him a telegram and go down to London for a few days.
Right, sir.
I rather want to see what he's making of that wee souvenir he took home with him.
Late the next afternoon, I sent Clifford and Elizabeth away from the laboratory. I wanted to study my notes alone, and there now seemed no purpose in watching the silent cylinder all the time. Also, Elizabeth seemed to be growing more depressed each day, as if something were weighing on her mind. She and Clifford retired rather discouraged, probably to spend the evening at their usual coffee bar, and I went home. At about 11 o'clock that night in my study in Eaton Square, I was examining a thick folder of calculations and diagrams. Professor McCracken, who had arrived with it an hour before, watched me curiously.
Well, is it or isn't it?
Campbell, I want to be the first to congratulate you. These figures are conclusive. A large orbiting body within the solar system. There can be only one explanation. A new tenth planet.
Orbit 10.
That's it. It's been suspected for years. A planet so distant, so dark, that no telescope, even yours, can detect it.
No. No, we would never have known without those signals. But that's where they're coming from, Hayward. Signals from the 10th planet.
It must be enormous, possibly even larger than Jupiter. A vast, frozen giant. And its journey around the sun must take something like 700 years. I wonder, Campbell.
Yes?
Well, suppose those cylinders of mine scattered over the Earth have some connection with it. They take in solid matter and it vanishes completely. It's a fantastic process and it must have a purpose. Is it possible that they absorb substances in order to transmit them elsewhere?
to send them perhaps back to where the cylinders themselves came from? Back across space? Back to the 10th planet itself? If so, oh, we're up against something so big we don't realize it's staring us in the face.
Another coffee, Liz?
Mm-hmm.
That one must be cold.
Oh, no, thanks. I'm not hungry.
I only said... Oh, I'll skip it. Well, if the Martians are on the way, they surely have a lulu of a technique. Nerve warfare. And we're the first victims. Any time now, we'll be at one another's throats.
Oh, Cliff, don't. Don't say things like that, even in fun.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Should we talk about the weather?
I'm tired. I think I'll go and... Oh, I left my file of notes in the lab, and I want to write them up at home. I'd better slip back and get them.
Not alone, you don't. Petrie won't be there. I'll walk up to the college with you.
No. I'd rather be on my own. I'll ring you tomorrow.
Okay. I'll stay here a bit.
Sorry, Kev.
No, forget it.
Good night.
All right.
Elizabeth left the coffee bar at exactly 11:35. She walked into Cromwell Road, entered the deserted college, and took the lift up to the third floor. Reaching the laboratory and switching on the lights, the first thing she did was look quickly at the rod standing in the denser-like cubicle. It was dull and silent. Elizabeth could see her own pale face reflected, distorted in its polished green surface. Automatically, she ran her eye over the recording instruments. The meter needles were all quite still. Near the cubicle lay the cylinder, a huge, empty shell. She smiled. Already, dust was gathering on it. She collected her folder of papers from the bench and walked back towards the door. And then, she stopped. Even before she looked round, she knew. By the air becoming colder each second, chilling, biting, and by the slow flood of unearthly green light which bathed the wall, confronting her with her own black, rearing shadow. And as she spun round, her breath made a white cloud, and something crackled under her feet, frost, forming rapidly, white and glinting. The green glare from the rod growing fiercer hurt her eyes. Then the vibration, rattling the benches and apparatus, dinning in her ears and dulling her mind. She found herself walking against her will towards the cubicle, her aching eyes fixed on the glowing core of the rod. Something seemed to be drawing her towards it. She bumped something. It clicked as she put out a hand, but she went on. She cried out, but her voice seemed not to belong to her, to come from a vast distance. Seconds passed. There was no thought in her mind. And then, something seemed to burn her fingers. Forcing her eyes down, she saw it was the lock bar of the cabinet, white with ice. She'd lifted it, and the door was swinging open. Now she was very close to the blazing rod, and softly, silently, a gray vapor was beginning to seep from its surface. With a frantic effort, she forced herself to think, to move, to step back. But the noise wouldn't let her think. Something somewhere was calling, demanding, willing her to obey. Her eyes fell on the laboratory telephone. One clear thought, one hope came, and she clung to it.
Telephone. Cliff. Coffee bar. Phone number. Seen it so often. Phone number on the menus. Think. Sloan. 01. Number on the menus. Sloan. Yes. 0181.
The frozen steel of the telephone dial bit at her fingers. It seemed to take all her strength to turn it, release it whirred back. Her mind was blurring, slipping away again.
Another one. And another. And another.
Hello? Oh, yes, he is here. I tell him. Hey, Mr. Clifford, your yes? young lady is on the phone for you.
Okay.
Hello? Cliff here. Is that you, Liz? Hello?
Oh, Cliff, I tried. I didn't know if...
Hey, Liz, what's wrong?
Oh, Cliff, please come. Please. I can't fight it much longer.
Oh, Liz, what is it? Are you in the lab?
Yes. Cliff, help me. I mustn't go back.
Liz. Liz! Honey, hang on. Whatever it is, hang on. I'll be right with you. Liz! Liz, are you in there? Liz, for heaven's sake, can you hear me?
Clifford had reached the college, the doors of the laboratory. They wouldn't open. Something had fallen across them, jamming them on the inside. Peering helplessly through the glass panels, he saw gray, swirling vapor. The room was choked with it, and everywhere a wintry whiteness of frost and ice. He saw dimly the open cubicle and the rod glowing a dull green. The telephone and its receiver just clear of the floor, swinging slowly on its cord. But there was no sign of Elizabeth. The laboratory seemed quite empty.
That was Orbit 10.
Tired of the everyday grind? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you Escape.
Escape. Designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
You are on a planet of desolation and utter ruin, awaiting the return of your comrades to carry you to safety. While the remains of life about you, crawling and evil, are slowly hemming you in and ruthlessly tracking you down to your death.
Listen now as Escape brings you Charles Smith's unusual story, North of Polaris.
Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4. Do you read me, Joe?
Loud and clear. R5, S5. All ready, sir.
How is he?
Well...
How do you feel, Mac?
Scared, sir.
Now take your time out there. Be very sure.
Quiet.
Can you see him?
Not yet, sir. Yes, sir, there he is.
Mac! What's it like out there?
Nothing much to see.
You feel heavier or lighter than usual? Can you move about easily?
Just like at home.
What about atmosphere?
I'm turning off my oxygen unit and opening the intake valve.
Careful. Not too fast now.
I've cut my supply completely, sir.
Rescue party standing by, sir.
It seems to be okay. Yes, sir, the air is good.
Are you sure?
It's okay. Send them out.
From the
port of the spaceship, we could see him calmly walking about on the surface of a planet approximately 20 million miles from our own. All 40 of us had drawn straws. Mac had won. And if we returned home safely, he would be remembered as the first man to touch the soil of an alien planet.
Well, Joe?
I guess I'm as ready as I'll ever be, sir.
Who else are you taking with you?
Stoner. He's good with the camera. Sam, have you got your gear to ready?
No. All set for the thing.
All right.
Now, you know what to do. What I want.
Yes, sir.
Map the area as best you can. Bring me a report on water sources, mineral deposits, vegetation. And if you see any signs of life, try to get pictures. But otherwise, avoid it. You can tell the others that's an order.
Yes, sir. Do you think there is life here, sir?
Well, some of our best minds have always claimed there was.
Well, when we get back, we'll set them straight, sir.
Yeah. I'll make our other drops and pick you up at this spot in 48 hours. So you're on your own. Good luck, Joe.
Thank you, sir.
Joe, do you notice anything wrong with this place?
What do you mean, Mac?
Well, look around. You see any trees, bushes, grass, anything growing? You see anything green?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's probably desert country.
No, look here. You feel the soil.
What?
It's rich enough. Gets plenty of sun, probably plenty of rain. Look at its color. Gray, dead.
Maybe it's like the moon. Maybe this is just another moon.
No, there's air here. There isn't any on the moon.
How you know? You ever been there?
Well, that's what they say, Sam.
Sometimes they're wrong. Well, what now?
Well, we got about 5 hours of daylight left. We'll head north.
I don't like it. It's too quiet. Not even the wind.
What are you trying to do, Mac? Don't you think we're jumpy enough?
How long are they going to leave us here?
48 hours.
That could be a long time.
We started north. It was easy walking over the flat rolling land, easy because there were no trees or bushes or weeds. There was nothing. Nothing but the gray sky and the gray dead soil. I was beginning to think that maybe it was only a moon. And then we made camp for the night.
Okay, come and get it.
Well, look here. Beans and K-rations. Just what I wanted.
Oh.
Now, watch your scans, they're hot.
Now you tell me.
You know the first thing I'm going to do when I get home?
Oh, what?
I'm going in the best restaurant in town and order the biggest steak in the joint.
You're pretty sure you're going to get home, aren't you?
Sure, I'm sure.
Why, aren't you, Mac?
I don't know. Hey, want some coffee, Joe?
Yeah, thanks. You married, Mac?
Uh-huh.
Any kids?
Yeah, one, a little girl. She's 5.
Yeah. What made you volunteer for this trip?
I don't know. Maybe I just had to. You understand that?
Yeah, I think so.
Hey, you know what I missed? The cricket. You know, at home you sit around a campfire, like at the lake. You hear the frogs and crickets.
And slap the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
It's funny.
No, what's that?
Well, here we are, 20 million miles away from our home. 20 million miles. And yet up there in the sky, we can still see it.
Yeah, I wonder if anybody's looking at this stinking planet and wondering if we made it.
Oh, sure they are. All the scientists, the astronomers.
No, I don't mean them, I mean...
I know what you mean.
You got a family, Sam?
Only my mother. She lives. Is this?
Hmm?
What? What is it? Something's out there. Moving.
It was life. There was life here. And we could see it now. In the dim light given up by our heating unit. It was an ugly, four-legged beast. With a hairless body, and from its odor, a scavenger. Like everything else here, it was the color of gray.
Get it off! Get it off!
All right. All right, cut it off! Bam! Well, that's real smart. You're supposed to be a photographer, take pictures of what we
find. Oh, lay off him, Joe. It was only a rat, a big rat.
The day broke clean and bright, and we kept walking north, doing the job we'd set out to do. And there were no other signs of life, and we'd almost convinced ourselves that the rat had been a stowaway from our ship. And for the first time, things felt right.
Hey, Joe!
What?
Hold it!
Stop wasting that film.
What's the matter? Don't you want your picture in the magazine? I've shot everything there is to shoot here. It's all going to look the same. Nothing.
Yeah, I know.
When we turn him back?
Tomorrow morning. There. Now let's take a look around.
What's the use? There's nothing to see. Hey, why don't we start back now? Joe? Joe?
Mac? Come up here.
What is it?
On the double. Here, take a look through these binoculars, Sam. Off to the east there. What do you see?
A lake. Yeah, maybe an ocean.
Now swing around slowly to your left. No, easy. There. What do you make of that?
I don't know.
Well, it's looks like clumps of stone or cement. Take a look. Give him the glasses, Sam.
Hey, could that be what's left of the city?
If it is. If we found...
Yeah! Yeah!
Sam! Sam, you fool! Come back here! But he wasn't coming back. Not now. He'd found the subject for his camera, and he was racing toward it. At the edge of the sprawling stone ruins, we caught up. And he made us turn with our backs to the city and pointed his camera at us.
Welcome to the city. Hold it, both of you, right there.
I should have shaved.
Hey, Mac, pick up a piece of that stone.
Like this?
Okay. Come on, what are you waiting for?
Hold it. Mac, put that stone down.
Hey, you think...
Just put it down.
What's the matter with you guys?
Geiger counter's acting up.
Are you kidding? What could be radioactive around here?
Mac, lower it near the ground.
Well, what do you know?
Radioactive? What is it, uranium, pitchblende, what?
No. Now, this isn't a natural composition.
Yeah, then what?
Look around you. Take a good look. What's it look like?
Just stone? The man of ruins? What else?
Look at the color of it. The edges.
Yeah. Like it's been burnt. Scorched. Remember what our cities looked like?
They wouldn't know about atomic energy here.
What makes you so sure? I led them on into the sprawling corpse of the great metropolis. Until we stood near the jagged base of what once must have been a magnificent building.
Mac?
Huh?
Over there.
What?
Look. Rat.
Yeah. Scrounging for food.
Oh, it sure did.
With each step we'd taken, the radiation had increased. And when it reached the danger point, we turned and started slowly back. We didn't say anything. We didn't need to. We had seen and we knew that this world, this civilization, had committed suicide.
It's getting late. We'd better make camp.
Well, this is as good a place as any, I guess.
Oh. I don't know about you guys, but I'm pooped.
Yeah, it's been a long day. You want to set up the stove, Mac?
Yeah, might as well.
The sky's clouding up in the south. Looks like a storm brewed.
Your film safe, Sam? You think the radiation back there damaged it?
Nah, it's packed in heavy lead foil.
No.
Cigarette, Joe?
Yeah.
That's funny.
No, what's that?
Take a look out there. No, south, I mean. It's not the sky that's clouding up. It looks like dust. Dust storm.
It couldn't be. There's no wind.
Take a look.
Yeah, but there's no wind.
Well, something's out there kicking up the dust. How far away you figure?
It's hard to tell. 10, maybe 15 miles.
Joe, look!
What?
There, to the right, about a mile, you see him?
See what?
No, over to your left. What is it?
People.
You're crazy. There's nothing out there.
Two of them. They fell. I can't see them now either, but I did see them. There. Now they're up again.
Joe's right. The people like us.
Hey!
Oh, hey!
All right. Stop
hey!
It. Stop hey! It.
Look, we've got orders to avoid contact with life here.
But, Joe, they're people, human beings.
You don't know what they are. Just because they resemble us physically, that doesn't mean a thing.
But, Joe,
we got our orders. The ground's higher over there. Let's move over there where we can see them better. Come on. When we made it to the rise, we could see a man and a woman. Two people just like ourselves. Even what was left of their clothing was similar to ours. And they were running desperately. And then I looked beyond them and saw the cause of their fear. Stalking them, slowly closing the distance between them, were six of those great evil rats. We stood there silently, watching the hunters and the hunted. And the longer we watched, the more it became certain that the rats could end the hunt whenever they wanted to. I could see their features now. The woman was much younger than the man. Their faces were distorted by panic and fear. And we watched and waited. And then the old man fell, and Sam and Mac were running, screaming, driving off the rats. Are you all right? Can you understand me?
Yes. Where's my father? I must go back to him.
The boys are with him. All right. You speak our language.
Yes. But we were sure there wasn't anyone else in this sector. We thought they'd all gone.
Gone where?
South. They left us behind. They said he was too old, not worth trouble.
How many of you live here?
11 of us.
Only 11?
Father and I started out yesterday morning. We thought we could meet them later. And then the rats... Where are you from?
Outside.
Then there is something left outside.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I was sure. I'd hoped. I knew it couldn't end here.
Come on, we'd better get you back to camp now. Sedative. She'll be all right, but I'm worried about the old man.
Hey, Joe?
Yeah.
We've been talking. How can they know our language? How?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
You know, it's like our world, isn't it? After the atomic war, I mean.
Yeah. I remember reading how the radioactive dust spread all over the land, killing everything. Grass, trees, animals, everything. Well, I guess the same thing happened here.
You off your rocket, Joe, with 20 million miles apart. And our war was over 50 years ago.
Look, don't you think it's possible that life on another planet could have started, advanced, and progressed step by step with ours?
Oh, Joe, now you're talking like something out of one of those science fiction magazines.
Well, what's the matter? Can't your ego accept it? Do we have to be the greatest, these super beings? Everything else in the universe is subhuman?
Oh, wait a minute, Joe.
Oh, knock it off. Look at this back.
Okay. It might be a good idea if one of us stood watch while the other two slept. How about that?
Sure.
Well, I'll take the first lap, and then you, Sam, and then Mac. Each of us will do 3 hours, huh? Now try to get some sleep. The 3 hours passed quickly. My mind was racing, asking if this world was a parallel to our own world. Were all the worlds of the universe alike? I was trying to find the answer when Sam relieved me, and I still hadn't found it when I dropped off to sleep. But I didn't sleep very long.
Sam! Sam!
Oh, good Lord, the rats. He must have dozed off. Come on!
made. We buried Sam just as the sun rose full above the horizon. And then as we turned to walk back to camp, we saw it. The sky to the south was black with dust. It was closer now, much closer than the day before. And whatever it was out there was moving straight for us.
What do you make of it, Joe?
I don't know. Jean?
Yes?
Does your father feel well enough to travel?
Oh, he's much better. He wants to talk to you.
All right.
Joe, how far are we from our rendezvous point?
Oh, about 12 miles.
Have you noticed the dust to the south?
Yes. I was hoping that you could tell us what it was, sir.
It is the army.
The what?
The army. The great army of the rats. The others. Those you saw yesterday and this morning, they were the scouts. Out there is the main force.
Why only rats? Why no other animal?
When the war started, the rats were already immune to radiation. They thrived on all other life perished.
But why?
Who did it? Who made them immune? We used them in our early atomic experiments, generation after generation. And generation by generation, their resistance increased until a rat was born who was immune to radiation.
What are we waiting for? Let's get out of here.
Yes, we must run. For now they are the masters, the rulers, and we are the scavengers.
Wait, my father.
Well, if you can't keep up, hold it. All right, hold up.
Oh, there's no use going on. Look there ahead of us.
Yeah, dust. More of them.
Behind us. To the north?
Yeah, they've cut us off.
No, they closed in for the kill. I told you it was an efficient army. Their strategy is well planned. They have a good general. As good a man as myself.
Father, please come.
Oh, now, now, these young men need me, Jean. They're outnumbered. We need time to muster our forces. Perhaps we could make a truce with the rats.
Talk, sir, will you?
Gentlemen, be reasonable. We have no other choice. You see how easily they outmaneuvered us? A truce is our only hope.
Make him shut up! Joe, he's crazy. He talks crazy. Don't let it get you.
How much time we got left before they pick us up?
7 hours.
We'll never make it.
Jean.
Yes?
Do you know this sector?
Yes.
Well, come with me, please. Mac, keep an eye on the old man. I didn't know what I was looking for or what I expected to find, but I had to do something. Even walking aimlessly over the scorched stone rubble was better than standing, waiting for the circle of rats to close in. And then Jean found it, an entrance to an underground bomb shelter, one just large enough to hold the average family. We raced back to where we'd left the others. And now we can hear the rats, thousands of them all around us.
Joe, I tried to stop him. He wouldn't listen to us. I quit.
What are you doing?
I couldn't help it. Believe me, I couldn't help it.
He was about 200 yards away, his shoulders back, his head held high, walking directly toward the rat. And in his right hand, he was holding a small white handkerchief, waving it back and forth like a flag of truce. He kept on until they formed a semicircle around it, and then he stopped. And all around us, the rats stopped. For a moment, I swear he spoke to them. And then he turned toward us, raised his hand in salute. And then the rats swarmed all over him.
No! Come on!
No, come on! Come on, Jean, you can't help him!
Come on!
We burrowed ourselves in a shelter. In a few moments, we could hear them overhead, hurtling themselves against the heavy, lead-lined doors, their yellow teeth digging at the concrete and steel. But it had been built to stand an atomic blast. It held off the rats. And we waited, For one thing, how long could we stay alive in that coffin? We didn't speak. We just sat there, wondering when they'd break through. Joe?
Yeah.
What's the use? Let's get it over.
No. No, they'll give up. They're starving. They leave to find some other food.
Hey, Joe.
Huh?
The rats. They're quitting, they're leaving.
Maybe they are. Maybe they just want us to think they are.
No. No, they're leaving. I'm going to take a look.
Mac, don't open that door.
Joe, listen, it's a ship. Clark and the ship. Come on, Joe, let's get out of here. Open it and see it. Hey! Hey! Down here! Hey!
Well, Gene, we can go out now. They've gone.
What?
It's all over. We're safe now. We can go out.
Out? Oh, my God. Yes.
We're going to take you back with us. Away from this. Now, come on.
Oh, no, please. Please, I'm afraid.
Afraid?
Don't you hear it? That noise?
Well, that's our ship. Here, I'll show you. Look, you see the landing?
Ship? I don't understand.
But the one that brought us here.
Brought you here?
Yes.
Where did it come from? Europe? Asia? Where?
Europe? Asia?
Oh, I knew we hadn't destroyed all of the Earth.
Earth? Is that what you call this planet? Earth?
This is the Earth. You. Where are you from?
What? Right up there. Just north of Polaris.
Under the direction of Anthony Ellis, Escape has brought you North of Polaris by Charles Smith, starring William Conrad as Joe, with Hi Averback as Mac, and Eddie Firestone as Sam. Featured in the cast were Vivi Janis, Ralph Moody, and Frank Gerstle. The special music for Escape is composed and conducted by Lee Stevens.
Now, from the makers of Cold Water Omo, Steed, on the premises of Casanova, Inc., found amongst the book-lined walls of the reception hall a door marked Rosemary Z. Glade, Director. As he opened the door, a woman's voice could be heard reading.
Her blue eyes filled with tears. "Defile me if you must, you villain," she whispered, "but my soul will never be yours."
Steed advanced into the room and looked at the attractive blonde who sat at a desk reading from a notebook.
"What do I care for your soul?" replied the fiend. "I have other fish to fry." With which base rejoinder, he put out a hand and...
Mortar's fevered brow.
Shh!
Oh, sorry, Rosemary.
I'm not Rosemary. He is.
Steed followed her gesture. Behind the desk, leaning back with closed eyes, was a tall, elegant man. His hands were crossed. On one of his fingers was a diamond ring with an entwined heart's motif.
The Avengers. John Steed and Emma Peel. The Avengers.
Episode 5 of this story, in which John Steed diagnoses a severe case of romance, and Mrs. Peel goes even further and joins those who... love all. John Steed was beginning to think that Emma Peel was right in insisting that love played a very big part in the security leak at the Department of Missile Redeployment. Several men working in the ministry had behaved in a very peculiar manner, and several other men were dead. It was clear that the enemy, whoever that might be, was aware that John Steed and Mrs. Peel were on the case and were out to stop them. Mother had sent Mrs. Peel back to the ministry, and John Steed had traced the concern known as Casanova Inc., the headquarters of Rosemary Glade, the celebrated romantic writer. Steed quickly controlled his surprise when the tall, elegant man rose from behind the desk and said,
I am Rosemary Z. Glade. And who are you?
An admirer. You've been a heroine of mine for years.
Yes, well, you've interrupted my flow.
Rosemary? Flow? And your name is?
Thelma. Oh, how could you be so thoughtless?
Only trying to help.
The master doesn't need help. He needs complete relaxation in order to feel the vibration.
Vibration?
From the astral plane. You don't suppose I could write the way I do if my mind wasn't in tune with the other world, do you?
I don't indeed.
And yet you come barging in here without so much as a bio leave, just when complete rapport had been established. Too bad. Oh, dear.
It's all right, Thelma. Don't upset yourself. Philistines will never understand. What can I do for you?
I'd like you to autograph my book.
I only give autographs between 3 and 3:15 in the afternoon.
Oh, what a shame. And I've bought every one of your books.
All 349?
Of course. I have them bound in purple morocco. I had to get rid of my Bronte first editions to make room for them.
Ah. Well, then you're entitled to one of our rings, my dear sir.
Rosemary opened a drawer in his desk and took out a box. He handed Steed a ring, one with the entwined heart motif.
Oh, thank you. How extremely thoughtful of you. Now I feel one of the family.
Well, since you're obviously a man of taste and refinement, I'll sign your book.
Steed whipped out a small pocketbook.
How gracious of you. If you'll just put, to John, with love from Rosemary.
Oh, certainly. There.
Oh, thank you. You know, I met someone with one of these rings only the other day.
Oh, who?
I can't recall the name. A very large man, had a black beard.
Oh, yes, it sounds like Freeman. He's one of our employees. All our employees wear the ring.
Is he here now?
Possibly. Ask Mr. Bromfield. He's in charge of our printing department. Through that door there.
Thank you.
As Steed moved off to the door indicated, Rosemary settled down and, closing his eyes, said,
No, where was I?
With which base rejoinder he put out his hand.
Ah, yes, yes. He put out his hand, grasped the yielding flesh of her arm in a vice-like grip. Unhand me, you base villain, she cried, her heart in turmoil, or it will be the worse for you. De Quincey laughed, a harsh, rasping sound that chilled her to the marrow of her bones.
Steed reached the printing room door, opened it, sighed, and closed it to find himself in the printing room. The man Bromfield approached.
Mr. Bromfield?
Yes, that's right. What can I do for you?
I was looking for Freeman.
They're not here at the moment. Is he a friend of yours?
Yes, I told him how much I enjoyed the books, and he promised to show me around.
I see. You're a fan, are you?
A fan? But of course. I never go to sleep without a Rosemary Z. Glade under my pillow. Love in the Bernese Oberland. That was my favorite.
You've seen Rosemary?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think I cut off his flow.
I shouldn't worry. That particular fountain will never run dry. Zathini?
Yes, Mr. Bromfield?
Bring Mr.
Steed.
Bring Mr. Steed an advance copy of Love in Budley Salterton, will you? Perhaps you'd like to take it with you. It's hot off the press.
Oh, too kind.
The creature called Athene picked up a parcel and handed it to Bromfield.
Not that one. You know perfectly well that those are forbidden. Already ordered. One from the other pile. There we are, Mr. Steed, with the compliments of Casanova Inc.
Thank you.
I hope it sends you to sleep as effectively as the others. Good night.
Oh, there is just one other little request. I've never seen a printing press in action. Do you think I might leave by the other exit and walk through the plant?
Certainly. Help yourself.
Steed did, by swiftly exchanging the book given to him with one from the top of the forbidden pile. No one saw the action.
Amazing. These small presses can produce so much magic.
Bromfield gave Steed a keen look and said,
"Goodbye, Mr. Steed. I hope you enjoy the book."
Steed shook hands, noting the now familiar ring, and left. Bromfield was standing staring after him thoughtfully when Martha, not in charlady guise, appeared from behind a pile of books and said,
"I've seen that man at the ministry."
"What?"
"He came to question Sir Rodney. I saw him again in Tate's office."
"Then he's too close for comfort. We'll have to deal with him."
"How?"
"Easy. The other fellow at the ministry, Friar, he's in love with your charlady act, isn't he?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Then all you have to do is ask him to do you a favor."
And so, not all that while later...
"A favor? A favor for you, of course. My darling, you have only to name it."
"Thank you, George. Oh, I knew I could count on you."
"Command me, then."
"I want you to get rid of somebody for me. Someone who's becoming a nuisance."
"A rival? His name. Quickly, his name."
"John Steed."
"Steed. I'll kill him."
"You took the words right out of my mouth, George."
John Steed, back in his apartment, opened the books he'd obtained from Casanova, Inc. The novel he discarded. The other book he opened and stared at in amazement.
"All the pages are blank. What's this? Set in the middle of the cover, a small indentation. A minute, sparkling eye. Fascinating."
Steed closed the book and went to open the door.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Fryer. Is something the matter? Well, come in. Forgive me for mentioning it, but that gun you're holding, the safety catch is off. But something tells me you knew that."
"I did. Put your hands above your head."
"Why? Why are you pointing that thing at me?"
"Because you're a philanderer."
"Beg your pardon?"
"You've trifled with a woman I love."
"I haven't trifled all day."
"She told me so herself."
"And now you're going to pay for it."
"Well, at least tell me her name." "So she's one of many, is she?" "Just as I thought. One of nature's parasites. The world will be a cleaner place without you, my friend."
"Look, can't we talk this over sensibly?"
"That's what they all say." "No."
"Well, in which case, there's nothing for me to do but..."
Steve stepped forward, grabbed the wrist that held the gun. With one swift movement, he forced the weapon out of Fryer's hand. Got a good grip and threw Fryer across the room.
"All for the love of the lady."
In the missile redeployment department, Mrs. Peel had been examining the office that had been occupied by Tate. She'd found the book marked Commission Report, Read, Digest, and Pass On. She'd been reading away with intense interest for hours. In the passage outside, Martha, in charlady outfit, whispered to Bromfield,
"She's in there. She's been reading the book. She's the girl I saw at Bell Chambers Perfume Shop. She's on to us."
"Then she's solving the problem for us. Is the door locked?"
"Yes. I locked it from the outside."
"Let me out! Let me out of here!"
"Leave this to me. I shall be the first person she sees."
"But who locked me in there? How dare you?"
"What? Oh.
Hello, my dear. I've come to take you away. Will you come with me?"
"Oh, yes. Yes. I'd follow you anywhere."
That kind of love isn't just blind, it's plain daft.
The Avengers. Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers, brought to you by the makers of Cold Water Omo. The Avengers, Donald Monat as John Steed and Diane Appleby as Emma Peel, is adapted and directed by Dennis Faulbig and produced by David Gooden.
Have a good evening and come back again next week. This has been Bill Holwick from West Texas for Broken Sea Audio Productions. www.brokensea.com. Good evening. Good evening. The music for tonight's episode was composed by Brian Seraphic Panopoli and Stevie Farnaby.